Tabitha. She watches Harper screech out of the driveway. After feeling a vengeful sense of triumph, she collapses on the bed and cries fresh tears. She goes all the way back to the original hurt. It's not fair that Tabitha got paired up with Eleanor and has spent her adult life being held to impossible standards, while Harper got to go with Billy and do whatever the hell she felt like doing. Running drugs, sleeping with Billy's married doctor. What happened the night Julian died was Harper's fault. Who else's fault would it have been? And yet, with Harper gone, Tabitha feels an absence way down in her core. Harper is, for better or worse, her twin. They aren't the same person, not at all. But Tabitha knows Harper, knows her down to her bone marrow, her tiniest cells. Does she love her sister? Yes, she acknowledges this. But the anger is all-consuming. Tabitha needs to even the score. She needs to exact revenge so that she and Harper are on equal footing. Tonight is her chance. Right now. She gets into the FJ40 and drives to our market in Oak Bluffs, where she buys a very cold bottle of Domaine Haute Rosé and a basic corkscrew, and, while she's at it, a couple of nips of Jägermeister. The cashier looks at her strangely and says, "Harper? I thought you left Island." Tabitha smiles brightly. "I'm back," she says. She drives up Island on South Road. She turns off on a dirt road because she needs a quiet place to drink and think. The road dead ends at some trees, but beyond the trees, Tabitha sees water. She carries her purchases out to a small beach, where she is instantly attacked by mosquitoes and no-see-ums. She doesn't care. This place has what she needs. Solitude. She has forgotten to bring a cup. She will have to drink the cold rosé from the bottle, like a Provençal hobo. Oh well. Since she is pretending to be Harper, she might as well start acting like Harper. She takes long draughts of the wine, then sucks back both nips. Her head spins. She hasn't eaten in days. Since lunch the day that Franklin first vanished. The wine loosens Tabitha up. She's able, finally, to breathe all the way in and all the way out, to loll her head on her neck, to stretch out her arms. Another few sips, and she will be on her way. Back in the car, she regroups. She collects her hair in a ponytail and smiles into the rearview mirror. In her own mind, she looks as different from Harper as anyone could, but the rest of the world sees them as identicals. Even Eleanor and Billy used to have trouble telling them apart. One year, Eleanor mislabeled the twins in the photo she sent with the Christmas card, and she never noticed. Tabitha and Harper had debated pointing it out, but they ultimately decided it wasn't worth the uproar. Eleanor would either have thrown the batch of cards away and made them sit for the photographer again, or worse, she would have stated that no one would know the difference, and so what does it matter? In Tabitha's memory, Harper had been more upset about the mistake than Tabitha was. She had lobbied to tell Eleanor, but Tabitha silenced her. Tabitha remembers feeling indignant about Harper's discontent. Why wouldn't Harper feel grateful about being mistaken for Tabitha? Why did she so vehemently want to establish her own identity? Back in the days of growing up, Tabitha had loved Harper more than Harper loved her. Is that possible? The year Tabitha had become a pony, Harper was the only person allowed to ride on her back, although friends and younger neighborhood children had asked. And throughout the entirety of their childhoods, Harper was the only person Tabitha would let brush her hair or scratch her back or apply her suntan lotion. Harper had been born with a thicker skin. She didn't care how she looked. She didn't care about grades or activities in school. She put in just enough effort to meet Eleanor's impossibly high standards, although she didn't much care about Eleanor's or Billy's approval. That indifference, of course, would catch up with her later. Tabitha drives out South Road toward Aquinna, keeping her eyes peeled for the simple wooden sign. She can't remember where it is exactly, but she's sure she'll recognize it when she sees it. Maybe she was distracted and missed it, or maybe it was closer to Chilmark than she thought. When she crosses the bridge, she knows she's gone too far, so she turns around and heads back. She will find it. She has to. But she hopes it will be soon, because she's losing daylight. Good old sheep crossing. The first cottage after the turn is where my brother-in-law is hiding out. Did he say the first cottage after the turn? Left or right? That night at the outermost inn seems like a long time ago. Then, just as Tabitha begins to wonder if she and Franklin even took South Road, maybe it was State Road? She sees the sign, Sheep Exing. Yes, this is it. She hits the brakes. Doubts gather in her mind like gawkers hovering around the site of an impending disaster. What is she doing? What does she hope to achieve? Tabitha drives past the first driveway on the left very slowly so that she can get a good look at the house. It's a simple salt box with gray shutters and white trim. It looks like any one of 100 homes on Nantucket. There's a black Lexus in the driveway and a racing bike leaning up against the porch railing. Black Lexus equals doctor car? Does Reed Zimmer ride a racing bike? Tabitha knows nothing about the man. She doesn't even recall what he looks like. She barely glimpsed him after being slapped and doused by his wife. All Tabitha registered was a male presence on the other side of Sadie, trying to control her. Tabitha drives past. The road becomes a dead end, but there is enough privacy for Tabitha to feel like she can pull over and rest a second. She swigs from the bottle of wine. And that, as it turns out, is the swallow that unlocks the vault in her mind. It's mid-August of 2003. Julian is not yet 3 months old. Tabitha looks like a woman who has been lost in the wilderness and given up for dead. She hasn't eaten a full meal or slept more than a few hours at a time since Julian was born. She and Julian are at home with Wyatt and Ainsley now. They have been permitted to leave the hospital, which makes things both better and worse. Better, because who wants to live in a hospital? Worse, because in the hospital, Julian was monitored all day, every day. Now that they're home, Wyatt has gone back to work, and Tabitha has been left with both Ainsley and Julian. Tabitha is frazzled, but that word is too cute to describe how on edge she is. At the end of their first full week at home, she snaps at Ainsley. When Ainsley cries, Tabitha shakes her, hard. Not hard enough to hurt her, but hard enough to scare herself. Tabitha calls Wyatt at work, sobbing. She can't do it, she says. She can't do it alone. He needs to come home and help her. And then we'll do what for money? He asks. He flat out refuses to accept financial help from Eleanor. It's almost like he's daring Tabitha to suggest it so he can leave her. Never mind, Tabitha says. The next day, Harper walks in the door. I'm here, she announces triumphantly, as though she is the answer to all Tabitha's problems. I took 4 days off work. I don't have to go back until Sunday. From her bag, she produces a bottle of Bilkar Saumon Brut Rose Champagne, which, she says, is ambrosial. She lifted this bottle from the restaurant where she waitresses, Dahlia's. But you paid for it, right? Tabitha says. Right, Harper says with a wink. With my hard work and exemplary attitude. Tabitha can't bring herself to care that Harper stole a bottle of champagne from her workplace. What does it matter? We won't get a chance to drink it anyway, Tabitha says. I'm nursing. So pump and dump, Harper says. I'm sure you have enough breast milk stored in the freezer to feed the Gosselin kids. This bottle has our names on it. Whatever, Harper, Tabitha says. She feels teary again for no reason. Maybe because she desperately wants to drink champagne, but she just can't. Julian starts to cry, and Harper says, There's my baby. She points at Tabitha. You sit. Or better still, go take a nap. I'll handle the kids, then get started on dinner. You look like Flat Stanley. Tabitha wants to protest. She wants to remind Harper that she has no idea how to take care of a toddler or a sick infant. It's not something she can bluff her way through. But Tabitha is too tired to state her objections. The idea of a nap, an uninterrupted nap, followed by a home-cooked meal is too seductive to turn down. As it turns out, Harper is a competent nursemaid and an excellent cook. She makes a bouillabaisse filled with scallops, mussels, and chunks of lobster. Tabitha eats three bowls with salad and crusty bread to sop up the juices, and then, amazingly, she feels like a human again. Harper's arrival on Nantucket is, in fact, an answer of sorts. Ainsley is 2 years old and newly verbal. She asks questions nonstop, the most frequent of which is why, to which Harper chooses among three answers. Because there is pie in the sky, because there's a sty in my eye, because the guy makes me sigh. Ainsley accepts all three responses with a solemn nod, as though she is being handed valuable pieces of wisdom. Harper is also terrific with Julian. She doesn't mention how pallid he looks. She doesn't compare his feeble crying to the sound of a wind-up toy that is running out of wind-up. She treats him as though he were a normal baby. She calls him stud and stallion. And when he's inconsolable and won't settle or nurse, Harper dances him around the room singing "If I Had $1 Million" by the Bare Naked Ladies, which puts him instantly to sleep. Wyatt is impressed. She's good with him. Tabitha nods. Half of her is resentful that Harper has proved so skillful with the children, but half of her is relieved. She has slept more since Harper has been here than she has in the 3 months prior. On her last full day, Harper gets up early and rides Tabitha's bike into town. She comes home with a bouquet of wildflowers that she bought from one of the farm trucks on Main Street. "Something to remember me by," she says, putting the flowers in water and leaving them on the kitchen counter. "And by the way, we're going out tonight." "No, we're not," Tabitha says. "Yes, we are," Harper says. Wyatt okayed it. He'll stay home with the kids. He thinks it's a good idea.
"He does not think it's a good idea," Tabitha says. Wyatt is terrified of being left alone with the children, which is one reason for Tabitha's exhaustion.
"Well, I talked him into it," Harper says. "We are going to drink the champagne I brought, we are going out to dinner, and we are going to dance at the Chicken Box." At this, Tabitha laughs. There is no way they're dancing at the Chicken Box. Tabitha hasn't been to the Chicken Box since her first summer on Nantucket.
"I don't think you get it," she says, "because you live a life free of responsibility. But I have two children, Harper. I'm a mother. I can't just go out on a wild bender."
"Who's talking about a wild bender?" Harper says. "We'll put the kids down, then go out. We have an 8:30 reservation at 21 Federal. Then to the box for the first set. Home by midnight. It's all arranged. You're not allowed to back out. You need this, Tabitha. I'm afraid if you don't let some steam off, I'll be back here next month to commit you to Sapphire Farms." Only now that so much time has passed can Tabitha effectively analyze why she let Harper talk her into going out. Was it the mention of Sapphire Farms, the mental institution for genteel Boston ladies who suffer mental breakdowns? Eleanor had several friends who had gone to Sapphire Farms, ostensibly because they needed a break from the city, though the twins knew a trip to Sapphire Farms meant that these ladies were either batshit crazy or at least unable to cope with daily survival. Was it that Tabitha was afraid of Harper, unable to stand up for herself and say no? Was it that being set free from her life, even for a matter of 4 or 5 hours, was too tempting to resist? Yes. Harper had presented an irresistible opportunity. She was the serpent offering an apple from the forbidden tree. And Tabitha, being a vulnerable and weak mortal, had taken a big, juicy bite. Tabitha doesn't remember being nervous or worried. She doesn't remember asking Wyatt whether he was really okay with letting her go out. She doesn't remember going back to give Ainsley and then Julian one more kiss.
She does remember putting on a gauzy white sundress. She remembers letting Harper braid her hair. She remembers plucking a marguerite daisy from the bouquet of wildflowers and sticking it behind her ear. They decide to carry the bottle of Bielkart Salmon down to the end of Old South Wharf, where Harper pops the cork off into the harbor, and they sit on the edge of the dock with their feet skimming the surface of the water as they pass the bottle back and forth between them, swigging and swilling and delighting in the lawlessness of it. Or at least Tabitha is delighting in it. She feels like a new person, or rather like an old person, the person she was before she became a mother at 22. They put on their sandals and walk to 21 Federal, Tabitha's favorite restaurant. Tabitha thinks about calling to check in with Wyatt, but she doesn't. If she hears the baby crying, her night will be ruined. They are seated at a two-top in the front room of the restaurant. They split a starter of portobello mushroom over Parmesan pudding, then they split the pan-roasted halibut and a bottle of very cold Sancerre. They split a creme brulee. Everyone in the restaurant is looking at them, doing double takes. Twins, identicals. There are men at the bar who offer to buy them an after-dinner drink. The men are well-dressed, older. They look wealthy. They look married. Ignore them, Harper says. They're just into the twin thing. But Tabitha doesn't want to ignore them. She never imagined she would feel desirable again. And these men seem so self-assured, so worldly. This was the kind of man Eleanor meant her to marry, she is certain. Eleanor did not mean for her to spend her life with a house painter who doesn't even have halfway decent health insurance. Tabitha winks at the men, then flutters her fingers in a wave. No, Harper says, pulling Tabitha up by the arm. We are not going down that road tonight, pony. Outside, Harper flags down a taxi, and they proceed to the chicken box. Harper buys them two beers apiece, then they wend and weave their way up to the front row, where they can see the band. They dance with abandon, hands in the air. The band plays With or Without You by U2, and Harper throws her arm around Tabitha's neck, and the two of them belt out the truest words ever written in a song. For them, at least. I can't live with or without you. They stumble home sometime after 1 in the morning. The hem of Tabitha's dress has been trampled. The braid is falling out of her hair. But she is happy. For the first time in months, she is happy. The house is quiet, and Tabitha shushes Harper, who is giggling and rummaging through the fridge for something to eat. Can I make popcorn? Harper asks. Too loud, Tabitha says. She tiptoes into the baby's room, and immediately her milk comes in. She groans at the prospect of pumping and dumping and heating up a bottle. She bends over to kiss her son. Because she is so drunk, so delirious with wine, music, and freedom, it takes her a moment to realize that something is wrong. Tabitha doesn't want to go any further in her memories, but the door to the vault is heavy, and now that it is hanging open, she can't slam it shut. Tabitha picks up Julian and presses his chest to her ear. Suddenly she is screaming, screaming, screaming. Harper appears first, holding a spoon smeared thick with peanut butter. Tabitha hands the baby to Harper, who drops the spoon.
Save him!
Tabitha cries, as if Harper might be able to do this. They run across the street to the hospital and burst into the emergency room. Harper is crying now, too, which scares Tabitha. Harper thrusts Julian into the arms of a nurse.
Save him!
She shrieks. The doctor on call performs CPR and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, but Julian doesn't respond. The doctor doesn't announce a time of death because the baby was dead on arrival. Sometime during the night, he simply stopped breathing. Where was Wyatt in all this? Tabitha wonders now. He was at the hospital. He must have been. Or did he stay home with Ainsley? Yes, that was it. Wyatt was at home, asleep in Ainsley's twin bed, a copy of Curious George Goes to the Zoo open on his chest, Ainsley fast asleep next to him. It would have made sense for Tabitha to blame Wyatt. The one and only night he was left home to care for the children ends in tragedy. But Tabitha had never blamed Wyatt for what happened. He was, at the time, as heartbroken and sick as Tabitha was, if not more so. No, the person Tabitha blamed was Harper. Harper had brought a bouquet of wildflowers into the house. Quite possibly it was the pollen from the Queen Anne's lace or the foxglove that overtook Julian's delicate lungs. Harper was the one who had insisted Tabitha go out. She led Tabitha astray. If Tabitha had stayed home, this wouldn't have happened. Harper's fault. Harper's fault. Harper's fault. Tabitha turns the car around and drives back to the cottage where the Lexus and the racing bike are. This is where Dr. Zimmer is living. Tabitha feels sure of it now. She swings into the driveway and kills the ignition. She strides up the walk and knocks on the front door, then waits. Her eyes burn. Her tongue thickens. What is she doing here? What is she going to say? She's not sure, but she can't seem to stop herself. The door opens. It's the doctor. She recognizes him instantly, from just that one glimpse of him at the reception. It's more than that, though. It's that Dr. Reed Zimmer recognizes her. His eyes fill with, well, the only word that comes to mind is wonder and love. Harper, he whispers. There is a catch in his voice. He can barely speak. This, Tabitha thinks, is how she wants Franklin to look at her. This, she realizes, is how Franklin does look at her. But that doesn't matter anymore. Hi, Tabitha says, and she steps inside. Nantucket. The High Line ferry accommodates wheelchairs, and so this is how Eleanor Roxy Frost travels back to Nantucket, accompanied by her sister Flossie and her longtime housekeeper, Felipa Ramirez. Eleanor doesn't love everyone on the boat treating her like an invalid, but although she can now take several steps by herself, she isn't able to make it up the ramp unassisted, so a wheelchair is a necessary evil. Her consternation about her disability is overshadowed by her relief at getting home to Nantucket. Boston has been her home all her life, but in the summertime, there is no place like this island. How many of us remember the summer of 1968 when Eleanor first set foot on Nantucket? She was on her honeymoon with Billy Frost. The two of them were cruising Nantucket Sound in a 50-foot Hatteras captained by a retired Cape Verdean fisherman named Barker. Barker had taken them to the vineyard for 3 days, where Eleanor and Billy had stayed at the Katama Shores Motor Inn. Billy had rented a CJ7 and driven them out to the nude beach. He had gone into the water without his trunks, but Eleanor kept her suit on, despite the other beachgoers looking at her like she was the odd duck. They had danced until the wee hours at the dunes a-go-go, and it was quite fun. But Eleanor had felt altogether more at home once they got to Nantucket, where things were a bit more staid. They had a suite at Robert's house amid the cobblestone streets. They walked 2 blocks each night to dine at the Opera House. They rented bicycles and rode to Sconset, where they lunched on oysters and vichyssoise at the Chanticleer. As they were leaving that lunch, they spied Paul Newman playing tennis across the street at the casino. "Shall we go introduce ourselves?" Eleanor had asked. "Absolutely not, darling," Billy had said. Eleanor had been keen to buy property on Nantucket, but Billy favored the vineyard, where, admittedly, prices were more reasonable. They quarreled about it for 20 years until they divorced, and then they both got what they wanted, Eleanor supposed, although she had certainly had moments when she'd wished she'd been more flexible. Eleanor has heard from Tabitha a handful of times, and from Harper twice, although conversations with both twins have been decidedly one-sided.
Eleanor talks about how she's doing, how she's feeling, her progress with physical therapy, and her struggle to get off the painkillers. One morning, she realizes that neither twin has said a word about herself, but then Eleanor realizes that if she asks how they're doing, they'll candy-coat the truth. To figure out what's going on, Eleanor will have to get home and see for herself. She is met at the ferry by her usual cab driver, Chet Holland. Chet's sister is a transgender woman in Toronto named Desiree, and Desiree Holland loves to wear the ERF label, a fact that secretly thrills Eleanor. Eleanor beams at Chet and introduces him to Flossie. "My baby sister, Flossie."
"Oh, yeah?"
Chet says. The sister is a younger, perkier version of Eleanor with platinum blonde instead of silver hair. And fake breasts, if Chet had to guess.
"You happy to be back on the rock?"
Flossie rolls her eyes.
"You can keep your Boston baked beans and foggy gray islands. I'm a Florida girl."
"Hell yeah," Chet thinks. He fills his own idle time daydreaming about Florida himself. He checks out the left hand of Eleanor's baby sister, Flossie, thinking he might like to take her out and show her what Nantucket has to offer. But Flossie sports a rock the size of the Titanic iceberg on her ring finger. Never mind. Chet pulls into Eleanor's driveway, off Cliff Road.
"Wait a minute," Eleanor says. "Is this the right house?"
"Sure is,"
Chet says. True, he hasn't driven Eleanor anywhere all summer, but this is her house, of that he is certain. He hits the brakes and waits for Eleanor to orient herself. She's getting older, plus she's a creative genius, at least according to his brother, sister, Dave Desiree. So maybe her brain is too crammed with new designs to recall what her house looks like. Einstein had a problem like that. He didn't know his own phone number.
"I haven't been here since Slick Willie was president," Flossie says. "But it's just as I remember it, Ellie. Prettier, even."
The housekeeper says something in Spanish that sounds urgent. She's pointing to the house.
"Wait a minute," Eleanor says.
She's confused. It is her house, but something is off. She curses herself for taking the extra oxycodone that morning. She felt she needed it to get through the ordeal of traveling, but it has left her addled. She snaps her fingers.
"I know what threw me," she says. "I do not recognize that car."
Here she points to the navy blue Bronco in the driveway of the carriage house. Whose car is that? It looks like something a spoiled teenage boy would drive, or a man going through a certain kind of midlife crisis. Maybe it belongs to a boyfriend of Ainsley's, or possibly a boyfriend of Tabitha's. Someone new? Eleanor does not at all understand why Tabitha broke things off with Ramsey Stryker. Eleanor didn't convey to Tabitha how heartbroken she was about the split. She dealt with it the same way she handled all unpleasant topics, by ignoring it. Eleanor studies the car another second. She has seen that car before, she realizes. She has ridden in it. But when? Then she remembers. She rode in it on the way to Billy's memorial reception. It's Harper's car. But why is Harper's car here on Nantucket? Eleanor rummages around in her mind. She can't think of any reason.
"Of course this is my house," Eleanor says. "I don't know what's wrong with me."
To Chet, she says, "Carry on." Philippa and Flossie make up the bedroom on the first floor, while Eleanor rests in an armchair on the glassed-in porch that overlooks Nantucket Sound. From the house phone, she tries Tabitha's number, but she gets no answer, and Eleanor doesn't believe in leaving messages. Eleanor is too exhausted to call the store. Honestly, that store is the bane of her existence. Tabitha has done a terrible job managing it in recent years, and the thing has become a financial albatross. Eleanor has given serious thought to closing it, but if she does that, what will Tabitha do for work? And this summer, Ainsley is working at the store as well, although Eleanor hasn't heard one word about how she likes it. Probably she sits around and plays on her blasted phone. Phones have become the scourge of modern society, if you ask Eleanor.
Possibly the best thing about Boston was how out of touch she was. Still, she has missed her water views, her Simon Pierce candlesticks displayed on the table in front of her, the smell of this house, and the chiming of these clocks. There are certain culinary delights particular to Nantucket that Eleanor has missed as well. The lobster bisque from the Sea Grill, the cheeseburger from Le Languedoc, the truffle Asiago frite from 56 Union. Would it be cruel of Eleanor to send Flossie out on a gastronomic scavenger hunt so that they might have all three items for dinner tonight? Eleanor can arrange for Chet to drive Flossie. He had seemed to take a shine to her. Yes, Eleanor will do exactly that. Flossie is headed back to Palm Beach the day after tomorrow. Eleanor needs to enjoy Flossie's companionship while she still has it. And she needs to find Tabitha. When Flossie comes out onto the porch carrying two giant Mount Gay and tonics, it must be 5 o'clock, Eleanor thinks. Flossie is always right on the nose with happy hour, and the drinks are always ice cold and very strong. Eleanor gives her the instructions for dinner. Flossie rolls her eyes. Can't we just get everything at the same restaurant?
No, Eleanor says. We can't.
Chet will chauffeur you around. You'll like that. He'll like that, Flossie says, and she trills her musical laughter. Also, Eleanor says, would you mind terribly going over to the carriage house to fetch Tabitha? Happy to, Flossie says. She raises her glass in a cheers. I'm not going to lie. I can't wait to get home. But I'm really going to miss you, Ellie. Eleanor feels color rising to her cheeks. It's true. The silver lining in the cloud of breaking her damn hip has been spending the past few weeks with Flossie. Sisters, she thinks. There's nothing like them. Flossie comes back a scant 10 minutes later. There's no one at the carriage house, she says.
No one?
No one, Flossie says. I left a note on the counter telling them we were home. Good, Eleanor says. I'm sure Tabitha and Ainsley are at the store. But by 8 o'clock that night, after the bisque, burger, and truffled fries are consumed and cleared away, there is still no word from Tabitha. Eleanor tries Tabitha's cell phone. Voicemail. She sends Flossie back over to the carriage house. Nobody home, Flossie says. Eleanor purses her lips. What is going on here exactly? She wonders. In the morning, Eleanor is awakened by the doorbell. She's disoriented at first, and the Ambien she takes each night to get to sleep leaves her voice as dry as crackers. She hears Flossie's light, quick steps on the stairs, then she hears voices. There is a tap on Eleanor's door. Come in, Eleanor croaks. The door opens and Tabitha steps in. Eleanor blinks. Where in God's name have you been? Mommy, Tabitha says. I'm Harper. What? Eleanor says. This is Harper? Well, it's first thing in the morning. The way Eleanor always used to tell the twins apart was that Tabitha's eyes were more almond-shaped and Harper's were rounder, as though she were in a constant state of amazement. But that distinction is only useful when the twins are standing side by side, and how long has it been since that's happened? I'm Harper, Tabitha says again. You're Harper, Eleanor says. She decides to be thrilled with this development. She has missed Harper. Harper went to live with Billy. But now Billy is dead. Billy is dead, and Eleanor is broken. It's a distressing state of affairs. They had been such a striking couple in their day. Eleanor notices something in Harper's face, something she hasn't seen in years and years, but that she recognizes nonetheless. Her daughter is upset. Her daughter needs her. Somehow Eleanor knows exactly what to do. She holds out her arms. Come, she says. Come to Mommy. The story tumbles out. Harper and Tabitha have switched places, just like the little minxes in that movie they used to love. Harper has been here on Nantucket taking care of Ainsley and minding the store, and Tabitha has been on the vineyard renovating Billy's house so the girls can sell it and realize a profit. Speaking of profit, Harper, with the help of some poor soul named Kaylee, that can't be her real name, can it? Eleanor wonders, has made some deeply unorthodox changes at the store, involving social media, Eleanor thinks with a shudder. But sales are up by 500% over last year. Eleanor accepts news of these changes with equanimity, surprising even herself. Probably she is not fully awake. But then Harper starts to weep. Eleanor hears about Tabitha's love affair with the builder and that the builder's sister is the woman Harper betrayed with Billy's doctor. The builder can't see Tabitha anymore, and Tabitha is heartbroken. Tabitha blames Harper. "She hates me, Mommy," Harper says. Eleanor loves that Harper still calls her Mommy, whereas Tabitha switched to Mother when she was 10 years old. "She hated me for so long. Then after Billy died, we patched things up, at least to the point where we were speaking. But now it's over for good." "Nonsense," Eleanor says. She dispatches Philippa to fetch the house phone, and not only does Eleanor call Tabitha, she also leaves a message. "Tabitha, this is your mother. I want you back on Nantucket immediately. No excuses. I expect to see you in a matter of hours, at the most." She disconnects the call and brushes the hair off Harper's shoulders. "You've gotten sun on your face," she says. She nearly launches into a lecture about wrinkles and premature aging, but because this morning seems to be unusual in its every aspect, she refrains. "A little color suits you." Martha's Vineyard. It's common knowledge that Dr. Reed Zimmer has taken a leave of absence from the hospital because of personal reasons. Most of us know that Dr. Zimmer admitted to having an affair with a patient's daughter. This was not cause enough to fire Dr. Zimmer, but it was cause enough for the hospital board president, Adam Greenfield, aka Greeny, to suggest he take a break until the brouhaha blew over. "We have the reputation of the hospital to consider," Greeny said. Dr. Zimmer reportedly accepted the censure without argument. He then moved out of the house he shared with his wife, Sadie. Sadie placed a sign in the door of her pie shop that read, "Closed UFN." This was a huge disappointment to the hundreds of summer visitors who counted Sadie's pies as a seminal part of their summertime experience. Some of us wondered whether Reed and Sadie had left the island together in an attempt to mend their marriage. Perhaps they headed to a place where nobody knows them. Their house, right next to the field gallery, would have rented for a pretty penny. At least that's what realtor Polly Childs thought when she drove by in her LR3. She was curious enough to pull up in front of the house and bold enough to knock on the front door. Polly was no stranger to island scandal and rumors, having once been ensnared in their vicious tentacles herself. Sadie Zimmer had answered the door. She knew who Polly Childs was, of course, though they had never officially met. "Yes?" "Just wondering," Polly said, "if you're planning on renting your home this summer. I have clients who would pay $10,000 a week for it in August." Sadie had given Polly a tired, barely tolerant smile. "Not renting," she said, and she closed the door in Polly's face. Later, people reported sightings of Sadie Zimmer at Allie's General Store and the Up Island Kronigs. Christine Vellman saw Sadie driving out to her parents' house in Katama, and in conversation a few days later during the meeting of the Excellent Point Book Group. Lydia Phelps confirmed that Sadie was remaining on the vineyard for the summer, although she was taking a break from the pie business. Reed had moved out, Lydia told Christine, although whether he was off-island or still on the vineyard was unknown. Most of us guessed he was off-island, and, as we know, off-island is a very big place. But then, late on the evening of the 4th of July, Ken Dahl nearly ran over a bicyclist on South Road. Thankfully, Ken Dahl caught a flash of reflective gear and swerved out of the way. But the incident flustered Ken Dahl. Who goes biking at 11 o'clock at night? He wondered. He was only on the road himself because he had to retrieve his teenage daughter, Justine, from a party at Lucy Vincent. He put the window down to shout a warning at the biker, but when he saw it was Dr. Reed Zimmer, he was so surprised that he hit the gas instead. He had heard that Dr. Zimmer had left the island for good. But no, Reed Zimmer was still on the vineyard, living in nearly hermetic seclusion at Sheep Crossing in a house owned by his medical school roommate's elderly aunt Dot, who let the house sit vacant except on the rare occasions when the medical school roommate used it himself. The medical school roommate, Dr. Carter Main, worked as the head of the infectious diseases department at the Cleveland Clinic, a demanding job that left him precious little vacation time. So when Reed called saying he had marital problems and asking whether he could use the house for the summer, Carter said, "Of course, man, it's yours. The key is under the mat. I'll let the caretaker know." Carter refused Reed's offer of fair market rent, because if anyone understood marital problems, it was Dr. Carter Main. He was on wife number 3, and he was about to leave her for a nurse in the burn unit. Carter's aunt's cottage is nothing special, but Reed doesn't want, nor does he deserve, anything special. Every minute of every day since Sadie caught him at Lucy Vincent with Harper has been excruciating. Reed fell out of love with Sadie all at once, a year and a half earlier. It was as if someone had thrown a switch from in love to not in love. This had happened in the dark days of January during a blizzard. Reed and Sadie had been trapped at home as the snow piled up outside. Sadie had built a fire and put a short rib and onion pot pie in the oven. She had opened a bottle of red wine and turned up Perry Connick Jr. on the stereo. She patted the seat next to her on the sofa and said, "Come sit with me." Reed dutifully sat, and she handed him a wine glass, which he accepted, despite the fact that he rarely drank, and when he did, that is, if there was no chance he would be called into work, he preferred beer or a scotch. They had clinked glasses, and Sadie said, "Kiss me." Reed could remember feeling repulsed. He had not wanted to kiss his wife. He had not been charmed or lulled by the cozy wintertime domesticity. He could see where things were headed. Sadie would want him to make love to her, and he simply didn't want to. He took a sip of his wine, hoping alcohol might work its magic, might make him feel something for the woman next to him. It was nothing short of deliverance when, a second later, the house phone rang. Reed was needed at the hospital. Reed had thought of himself as saved, spared. But Reed wasn't a quitter. He was thoughtful and methodical by nature. He figured that if the switch could be turned off, then it could also be turned back on. The night of the blizzard, he had been called upon to deliver a baby. Dr. Vandermeer, the OB, was stuck in Woods Hole, and Reed, who had not been in a delivery room since his OBGYN rotation in medical school, found the experience enormously gratifying. The patient was a first-time mother, Allison, who had been determined to give birth without drugs, but the baby was big, and it was a struggle. Allison was swearing and screaming. The agony on her face troubled Reed, and he almost encouraged her to give in, at least take some Nubane. But in the end, he was glad he didn't. Allison handled each contraction like a mountain she had to summit, and Reed and the two labor and delivery nurses cheered the way they might have for an elite athlete, Michael Phelps or Lindsey Vonn. After 4 hours of fight and nearly 50 minutes of pushing, Spencer Douglas entered the world weighing nearly 9 pounds, a beautiful, healthy baby boy. When Reed and Sadie reunited post-blizzard, nearly 36 hours later, Reed described the birth to Sadie. He detailed Allison's determination, the focus in her eyes, the strength of her will, the raw power of a female when she was in the midst of her most profound and fascinating function, giving birth. Reed had been a doctor for more than 20 years by that point, but he had still been struck by the nobility of it. He had grasped Sadie by the shoulders. "We should have a baby." "What?" she said. "Why not?" Reed said. Since the birth of Spencer Douglas, Reed had cottoned to the idea of having a child. Children, as Reed understood it, often saved marriages. But at the mere suggestion of having a child, it seemed that Sadie's own switch had flipped to the off position. It wasn't just that she dismissed the idea, it was that she was viscerally offended by it. She had believed them to be of a single childless mind. Reed's change of heart was a betrayal. Sadie slept in the guest room that night. But then, a few days later, Reed found her back in their bed, and he thought she had come to her senses. However, when he tried to crawl in, she'd stopped him.
"I shouldn't be the one sleeping down the hall," she said. "You should."
And so for the next year and a half that followed, Reed had been sleeping alone. Not only did Sadie not sleep alongside him, she also wouldn't touch him at all. She avoided his hands when he passed over the car keys or the newspaper. She steered clear of him in tight spaces. At certain junctures, Reed wondered how long she was planning on keeping up the embargo. Of the two of them, Sadie had been the more physical, the first to initiate sex, the first to offer a back rub when Reed had had a bad day at work, the one who insisted on holding hands at the movies. One night, Reed said, "You can't get pregnant with your IUD in, you know, Sadie, no matter what I may or may not want."
"I know," Sadie had said.
Her resistance to him seemed to have nothing to do with any actual fear of getting pregnant. Rather, it was an act of hostility, of power, of torture. Reed relieved his urges in the shower. He went for long bike rides. He stayed overnight at the hospital. The nurses commented on his devotion to the patients. It was back in October, after nearly 10 months of living without touch, kiss, or caress, when Reed bumped into Harper Frost at Morning Glory Farm. He had noticed the woman standing in line in front of him because of the pleasing way her ass filled out her jeans. When she turned around and he saw it was Harper Frost, the daughter of his patient Billy Frost, he was pleasantly surprised. Reed liked Harper for a couple of reasons. She was down to earth. She was concerned about Billy's treatment, but not uptight. She and Billy had a charming, irreverent repartee. Reed enjoyed listening to the two of them parry. Harper teased her father about his smoking, his drinking, and his legion of female admirers, and Billy teased Harper right back about her nagging him as though she were his wife or mother. He called her my old lady. The two of them seemed very close. They talked about scalloping, fishing, Dustin Pedroia and the future of the Red Sox, Billy's handicap at Farm Neck. Billy claimed it was a 3, but Harper said it was 111, and a restaurant in the North End that made a crab and artichoke ravioli they loved. Listening to them, Reed once again felt a pang for a child of his own. Who, he wondered, would take care of him in his old age? Sadie? Not likely. At the farm, he bought Harper a cup of coffee, and they sat and talked, and it was the happiest hour Reed had passed in some time. 2 weeks later, when Reed asked Harper to go for a drink, it was a spur-of-the-moment decision, but also one he'd been considering since they parted ways at Morning Glory Farm. Reed knew it was a risk, going for drinks, which turned out to be dinner as well, with a patient's daughter. But until they walked out of Atria that night, Reed was still able to tell himself they were only friends. Reed had a populated life, his patients, his colleagues at the hospital, his wife's family, but he hadn't had a friend since medical school except for Sadie. And now, it was safe to say, Sadie was no longer his friend. Reed had started kissing Harper. Why? Because the night air was finally crisp after such a hot summer? Because he was high from the wine, the food, the companionship? Because at dinner, Harper had unwittingly brushed his shoulder and knocked her knee against his? The circumstances demanded it, Reed thought later, when he tried to rationalize his actions. But that was cowardly. The decision hadn't been foisted upon him by outside circumstances. The decision had been consciously made by him. Once Reed had kissed Harper, once he had made love to her in the back seat of his car, well, The genie could not be put back into the bottle. He thought about her nonstop. At first, it was only sexual. His brain was engulfed in a fog of overwhelming desire for an act that he had been so long denied. A few weeks in, however, there were intimate conversations and the inevitable sharing of histories, and Reed realized that Harper was an extremely complex human being. He heard about her upbringing, her parents, her identical twin, her elite private school, her rarefied life in a townhouse on Beacon Hill. But then that particular storybook ended. Her parents divorced, Harper attended Tulane, then moved to Martha's Vineyard to live with Billy. Reed heard about her series of jobs, scooping ice cream, selling carousel tickets, landscaping for Jude Hogan, and one or two nights a week, serving drinks at Dahlia's. Reed was both proud and ashamed to say that he had never set foot in that particular establishment. It was rumored to be a hotbed of cocaine, infidelity, and summer money. Harper had fallen prey to the scene. She had agreed, on one occasion, to deliver a package for Joey Bowen. She had not known there would be any danger, but she had ended up handcuffed and lying face down on a client's lawn. There was a fair amount of public shame, she told him. Reed pointed out that it might have been worse. She could have ended up in jail. Harper said she would rather have served her time. Instead, the citizens of the island seemed determined to make her pay in other ways. Reed and Harper saw each other once a week at first, then more often. But when the weather started to warm up, Harper became less available. Reed then discovered that she had started dating an Edgartown policeman, the young, charismatic, well-connected Drew Truman. Reed couldn't believe the way this discovery pierced him. He had never in his life felt so jealous. He realized he had no right. They had made no promises. But he didn't care. He couldn't stand the thought of Harper with anyone else. He left the hospital mid-shift and showed up at her duplex and demanded that she break things off with Drew. She had laughed in his face. Dr. Reed Zimmer, a pillar of the hospital, if not the community, found himself caught in a conundrum commonly experienced by lesser men. He was in love with someone other than his wife, but unsure if he had the gumption to leave his marriage. To leave would bring pain, shame, scrutiny. He didn't think he could stand it. He liked being held in high regard, which was, he realized, a character flaw in itself. Reed had allowed himself to believe that he was invincible. Unlike every other unfaithful man in the history of the world, he would not get caught. He would stay with Harper until Sadie left of her own accord, and surely that would be soon. Sadie was as miserable in the marriage as he was. In the spring, she started talking a lot about Tad Morrissey, the Irish carpenter who worked with Franklin. Tad was wonderful, Sadie said. Tad had come to the pie shop to build some new shelves, and he had shimmed the back door, which Sadie had always had a hard time closing in the summer. Reed convinced himself that Sadie was having her own affair with Tad Morrissey. Was there anything wrong with that? Reed wondered. He and Sadie were both being discreet, keeping up appearances. They went together to the start of summer barbecue at Lambert's Cove with Sadie's family. Reed liked Sadie's family. Her parents, Al and Lydia, her brother Franklin. Lo and behold, Franklin brought Tad Morrissey with him to the barbecue as his date, he joked. But really, Reed suspected, Tad was Sadie's date. Possibly Franklin knew about Sadie, and Tad was in on the deceit. Certainly no one batted an eye when Sadie sat next to Tad by the fire, or when Sadie jumped up to fetch Tad more potato salad. While you're up, I'll have a little more as well, Reed had said. But Sadie had pretended not to hear him. Sadie only paid attention to him that night when he was checking his text messages and when he stepped away from the fire to call Harper back. Where are you going? Sadie asked. You're not on call tonight. I had a patient die unexpectedly, Reed said. Lydia heard this and crossed herself. Sadie rolled her eyes, which only showed how much her contempt for him was spoiling her soul. She turned away, asked Tad if he wanted another beer, and Reed was free to talk to Harper. He should never have met her at Lucy Vincent. In retrospect, that much was obvious. But Billy had died, and Reed was taken as much by surprise as she had been. Billy had congestive heart failure and myriad other ailments, but Reed had thought he would last weeks longer, maybe even the entire summer. Some people had a dogged survival instinct, and Billy Frost was one of them. He had seemed like the kind of man who could live forever, despite his terminal condition. Reed had thought Sadie was asleep when he left the house. She had been in their bedroom with the door closed, the lights out. Reed no longer kept any clothes or belongings in that room, so there would be no reason for him to open the door and check on Sadie. If she was awake, she would think he was coming after her for sex. They had both had a lot to drink at the barbecue, and whereas this sometimes led to a fight, on the ride home, Sadie had been benign, nearly kind. The result, Reed assumed, of spending an entire evening in close proximity to her beloved. He eased the Lexus out of the driveway, feeling like a teenager sneaking out from a house ruled by overbearing parents. Once he hit South Road, he experienced a heady sense of freedom. He was alive. How many moments of how many days had he failed to realize that? If someone had asked him then if he had any intention of going back to Sadie that night or ever again, he might have shrugged and said, "What for?" Sadie had trailed him. She had heard the car pull out, or perhaps she had sensed something, overheard part of his conversation with Harper, read some impending deception on his face, and jumped out of bed. Possibly she had been waiting for him to go to bed so she could sneak out to meet Tad. However it had happened, he had been caught with Harper in the parking lot of Lucy Vincent. Caught. At first, he thought he could talk his way out of it, using a measured voice and reasonable calm. Sadie had been quite drunk. Her eyesight wasn't reliable. It had been dark, and she was without her glasses. But Sadie had embarked on a full-blown investigation, which Reed, unfortunately, didn't discover until after Sadie made the abhorrent scene at Farm Neck. In the days that followed Billy Frost's memorial reception, the affair between Harper Frost and Dr. Reed Zimmer was all anyone talked about. It made Reed queasy to think about how lurid and trashy his private life must seem, that he had been revealed to be just one more faithless slug, a cheater. Sadie forced Reed to go to his in-laws' house in Katama to confess. Al Phelps had cast his eyes to the floor, uncomfortable and embarrassed at hearing Reed's admission of guilt. Lydia had cried as though she were the one Reed had betrayed.
"Shame on you," she'd whispered.
Reed would have liked to explain how bad things were at home, that Sadie wouldn't sleep with him, wouldn't accept a cup of coffee from his hands, wouldn't kiss him goodbye when he left for work. But what did that matter? There were two kinds of people, the faithful and the unfaithful. He was unfaithful, and he had blithely chosen to believe that his wife was also unfaithful. He had created a whole fantasy relationship between her and Tad Morrissey, which, he realized now, was only for the benefit of his aching conscience. Greeny, Adam Greenfield, the president of the hospital board of directors, had asked him to take a leave of absence for the summer. "Go away," he said. "By September, this will be old news." Reed had, initially, considered leaving. He could go to California, Oregon, Washington State, Alaska. He could return to Cincinnati, where he had grown up. He could spend a nostalgic summer driving past the house where his parents had raised him, with tall, cold glasses of milk placed at the 1 o'clock position above his dinner plate, where he had conducted open-heart surgery on a frog he found floating in his mother's koi pond, where he had learned how to mow a lawn in contrasting diagonal stripes, and where he had played third base in summer league baseball. Third base had been the perfect home for him, a lefty. He would eat chili from Skyline and ice cream from Grater's. He would track down Tracy Sweeten, the girl with blonde feathered hair whom he had loved in seventh grade. When Reed bumped into Tracy or other people he'd known growing up, they would say they'd heard he was a doctor back east. A few might remember that he lived on an island, although he doubted anyone would be able to imagine the vineyard. Cincinnati was flat, Midwestern. It was cornfields and trout ponds, as far from the cliffs of Aquinnah, the surging Atlantic, and East Coast elitism as one could get, aesthetically and philosophically. Reed had chosen to stay because when it had come time to drive his Lexus onto the steamship, second thoughts had taken him hostage. He didn't want to run away. He turned the car back toward Oak Bluffs and checked into a new hotel called Summer Camp. It was so new that the receptionist didn't display any recognition when he gave his name. And then, out of desperation, he'd called Carter Main. Aunt Dot's house was on a road that few people knew about. The first thing Reed did when he got to the cottage, after stocking up on groceries at the Stop and Shop in Edgartown, which was so overrun with tourists that again he went unrecognized, was to shut off his cell phone. And then, because he feared that shutting it off wouldn't be enough, he threw it into the woods behind the house. He was tempted every minute of every hour to call Harper. Greeny had, somehow, heard that Harper had lost her job and left the island, although even Greeny admitted that this was merely the word on the street. Reed had driven by her duplex and had not seen her Bronco out front, but that didn't mean anything. Was Harper gone? Where would she go? She had never expressed any desire to be anywhere but Martha's Vineyard. In this, they were alike. Reed's summer had been quiet, indeed silent, until Sadie had somehow discovered where he was. She was the one who had wanted him out of the house, wanted him gone. She didn't care where, just gone. And yet apparently she had called Carter and bullied him into telling her the truth. Reed was staying at Aunt Dot's house. Or maybe bullying hadn't been required. Carter had always been weak when it came to women. Sadie had stopped by the house only once, ostensibly to see if he was okay. But she had ended up calling him names, calling Harper names, hurling insults, and then, finally, tear-stained and hiccupy, she had asked, "Do you love her?" She had not been brave enough to ask before, and Reed had been grateful. He said, "You left a vacuum. And as I'm sure you recall from reading Aristotle, nature abhors a vacuum."
"That's not an answer to my question," Sadie said.
The answer to Sadie's question was yes. He loved Harper. To say so seemed cruel, but Sadie must have read it on his face because she turned and left before he could say anything. Reed lived a quiet, deliberate life in the manner of Thoreau. Being without a phone, without any way to communicate, was rather like ceasing to exist except in the present moment. He rose at 4:30, a benefit of living at the far eastern edge of the time zone, light this early, and biked to Great Rock Bight to swim, returning along North Road by 6 or 6:15 before the rest of the island, most of them on their summer vacation, thought to stir. He hermited himself most of the day, reading paperback novels from Aunt Dot's shelves. He read Elmore Leonard's Get Shorty and Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. He read Jaws and The Caine Mutiny and This Side of Paradise, which put him to sleep 4 days in a row until finally he gave up on it. He biked again at night, after dark. He fixed himself a simple supper at 10 or 11 and slept fitfully, dreaming of Harper. His neighbor, two doors down, was an executive with Coca-Cola from Atlanta named Dick Davenport. Reed wondered whether this was a made-up name, who stopped by to ask if Reed would mind picking up his newspaper while he was away. He had daily delivery of the Vineyard Gazette. Reed didn't love agreeing to a regular obligation, but no sooner did Dick Davenport ask than Reed realized Dick must have mistaken him for Carter, so Reed felt he had to say yes. He then took to reading the Gazette every day, and this was how Reed discovered that Brendan Donegal had died. Reed's heart broke for Harper. Brendan had been Harper's friend. He was a person she had steadfastly visited on Chappie twice a week, no excuses. The obituary in the paper detailed Brendan's early life on the vineyard and his surfing successes. Major competitions won, endorsements. Then it described the accident on South Beach, drugs the likely culprit. He convalesced from the accident with his mother in her home on East Beach. A couple of days earlier, he had suffered an accidental pharmaceuticals overdose. Reed feels certain that wherever Harper has been hiding, she has heard the news of Brendan's death and will return to the vineyard, even though the newspaper explicitly mentions that there is no service planned. Reed awakens the day after he reads the obituary and feels Harper drawing closer to the island. She's on the ferry. She's with Fish. She's wearing her white denim shorts and Billy's light blue golf shirt. Her hair, which normally hangs heavy and long, is in a ponytail, a concession to the heat. Reed has half a mind to drive to the Vineyard Haven ferry dock to pick her up, but then he realizes he has completely abandoned all reason. He isn't picking up Harper's aura or her energy. Reed is a scientist. He doesn't have a mystical bone in his body. He only pictures Harper in the white shorts and blue shirt because that was the last outfit he saw her in. It was a day or two after Billy's reception. Reed had chanced to drive past Harper's duplex because he had been powerless against his desire to see her and talk with her in person about what happened. He had sent her a text message asking her not to contact him, which was curt and cruel. He wanted to remedy that. But when he was on approach, he saw Harper coming out of the house. She climbed into the Bronco and drove off in haste. She was going to meet someone, Reed had thought. Probably Drew Truman. Reed had carried on to the hospital. And as for him envisioning Harper with Fish, well, that was a given. If Harper returned to the island, she would have Fish with her. But still, the feeling lingers, insistent, pervasive. Harper is coming home. It's no surprise, then, when Reed hears the knock on his front door. It's 8:10 at night. The sun has descended past the tree line on Sheep Crossing. It's dusk, but not dark. Reed tries not to anticipate. It might be the goofy neighbor or a Jehovah's Witness, although the hour is a little late for both. He opens the door, and there she is. She is not as he imagined her. She's wearing jeans shorts and a hot tin roof t-shirt, neither of which he's seen before. There is something off about her face that he can't quite pinpoint. But then again, he thinks, he isn't the same either. He must look like a different person to her as well. Harper, he says. She goes to him. Tabitha. He kisses her, long and deep. It's a skillful kiss, she thinks, but she feels nothing except a sharp stab of longing for Franklin. Chemistry between two people is a slippery, elusive thing. Love is not transferable. Still, she participates. The thrill here is in the deceit. She tries to imagine what Harper would do and decides to run her hands through the doctor's hair. Yes, this appears to be right. The doctor kisses her more deeply, pulls her closer. Tabitha feels him stiffening against her leg, and she hesitates. Kissing is one thing, but how far is she willing to go? When she knocked on the door, she had assumed all the way. Anything less would be shy of revenge. The doctor's hand travels up the inside of Tabitha's shirt. He is clearly fooled, even though Tabitha is, as Eleanor so kindly pointed out, heavier than Harper, a little thicker in the midsection. The doctor reaches up to unfasten her bra. Whoa. She pulls away, casts her eyes down. Hey, the doctor says, I love you, Harper. You need to know that. I love you. Tabitha nods as tears fill her eyes. The doctor loves Harper, and no doubt Harper loves the doctor. But because of this, Tabitha is doomed to be alone. I love you too, she whispers to the floor. She allows the doctor to lead her by the hand to the back bedroom. With each step, she considers turning around. She had intended to betray Harper, but with each passing moment, she becomes more aware that she's betraying Franklin. If he could see her right now with his brother-in-law, he would... What? Tabitha is also betraying the doctor, which bothers her as well, though less. The doctor is hardly an innocent in all this. As the doctor shuts the door behind them, Tabitha reluctantly sits on the bed. The doctor lifts her shirt up over her head, removes her bra, gently encourages her to lie back. He starts kissing her stomach. It's then Tabitha realizes that the person she is ultimately betraying is herself. Stop, she says. The doctor, obedient, looks up. He sees something in her face. Or he doesn't see something. Harper, he says. No, she says. I'm not Harper.